Society in the new book, American Fascists. He spoke about it recently here in Washington for about an hour.
Tonight, we are welcoming Chris Hedges. Chris has been a foreign correspondent for 15 years. He is on the staff at the New York Times and was a member of the team that won the 2002 Pulitzer Prize for explanatory reporting for the paper's coverage of global terrorism. Chris Hedges has been, He has also worked for the Dallas Morning News, Christian Science Monitor, and National Public Radio. He holds a Master of Divinity from Harvard University. He is the author of Losing Moses on the Freeway, The Ten Commandments in America, What Every Person Should Know About War, and War is a Force That Gives Us Meaning. Tonight, he is talking about his newest book, American Fascist, The Right, The Christian Right, and the War on America. Please join me in welcoming Chris Hedges.
Thank you. Dr. James Luther Adams, my ethics professor at Harvard Divinity School, told us that when we were his age, and he was then close to 80, we would all be fighting the Christian fascists. The warning given to me 25 years ago came at the moment Pat Robertson and other radio and televangelists began speaking about a new political religion that would direct its efforts at taking control of all institutions, including mainstream denominations and the government. Its stated goal was to use the United States to create a global Christian empire. It was hard at the time to take such fantastic rhetoric seriously, especially given the buffoonish quality of those who expounded it. But Adams warned us against the blindness caused by intellectual snobbery. The Nazis, he said, were not going to return with swastikas and brown shirts. Their ideological inheritors had found a mask for fascism in patriotism and the pages of the Bible. Adams was not a man to use the word fascist lightly. He was in Germany in 1935 and 1936 and worked with the underground anti-Nazi church known as the Confessing Church, led by Dietrich Bonhoeffer. Adams was eventually detained and interrogated by the Gestapo, who suggested he might want to consider returning to the United States. It was a suggestion he followed. He left on a night train with framed portraits of Adolf Hitler, placed over the contents inside his suitcase to hide the rolls of home movie film he took of the so-called German Christian Church, which was pro-Nazi, and the few individuals who defied them, including the theologians Karl Barth and Albert Schweitzer. The ruse worked when the border police lifted the top of the suitcases, saw the portraits of the Führer, and closed them up again. I watched hours of the grainy black and white films as he narrated in his apartment in Cambridge. He saw in the Christian Right, long before we did, disturbing similarities with the German Christian Church and the Nazi Party. Similarities that he said would, in the event of prolonged social instability or a national crisis, see American fascists, under the guise of religion, rise to dismantle the open society. He despaired of liberals who, he said, as in Nazi Germany, mouthed silly platitudes about dialogue and inclusiveness that made them ineffectual and impotent. Liberals, he said, did not understand the power and allure of evil, nor the cold reality of how the world worked. The current hand-wringing by Democrats, with many asking how they can reach out to a movement whose leaders brand them as demonic and satanic, would not have surprised Adams. Like Bonhoeffer, he did not believe that those who would fight effectively in coming times of turmoil, a fight that for him was an integral part of the biblical message, would come from the church or the liberal secular elite. His critique of the prominent research universities along with the media was no less withering. These institutions, self-absorbed, compromised by their close relationship with government and corporations, given enough of the pie to be complacent, were unwilling to deal with the fundamental moral questions and inequities of the age. They had no stomach for a battle that might cost them their prestige and comfort. He told me, I suspect half in jest, that if the Nazis took over America, 60% of the Harvard faculty would begin their lectures with a Nazi salute. But this too was not an abstraction. He had watched academics at the University of Heidelberg, including the philosopher Martin Heidegger, raise their arms stiffly to students before class. Adams also reminded us that American intellectuals and industrialists openly flirted with fascism in the 1930s. Mussolini's corporatism, which created an unchecked industrial and business aristocracy, appealed to many American industrialists at the time, who saw it as an effective counterweight to the New Deal. In 1934, Fortune magazine lavished praise on the Italian dictator for his defanging of labor unions and his empowerment of industrialists at the expense of workers. Adams, finally, told us to watch closely what the Christian right did to homosexuals. He had seen how the Nazis had used values to launch state repression of opponents. Hitler, days after he took power in 1933, imposed a ban on all homosexual and lesbian organizations. He ordered raids on places where homosexuals gathered, culminating with the ransacking of the Institute for Sexual Science in Berlin. Thousands of volumes from the Institute's library were tossed into a bonfire. Adams said that homosexuals would be the first deviants singled out by the Christian right. We would be the next. The ban on same-sex marriages, passed by 11 states, was part of this march towards our door. A 1996 federal law already defines marriage as between a man and a woman. All of the states with these ballot measures, with the exception of Oregon, had outlawed same-sex marriages, as do 27 other states. The bans, however, had to be passed, believers were told, to thwart activist judges who wanted to overturn them. The Christian family, even the nation, was under threat. The bans served to widen the splits tearing apart our country. The attacks on homosexuals handed to the foot soldiers of the Christian right an easy target. It gave them a taste of victory. It made them feel empowered. But it is ominous for gays and for us. 2 decades later, even in the face of the growing reach of the Christian right, Adams' prediction seems apocalyptic. And yet the power brokers in the Christian right have moved from the fringes of society to the executive branch, the House of Representatives, the Senate, and the courts. The movement has seized control of the Republican Party and holds a majority of seats in 36% of all Republican Party state committees, or 18 of 50 states, along with large minorities in 81% of the rest of the states. 45 senators and 186 members of the House of Representatives earned between an 80 to 100% approval rating from the three most influential Christian right advocacy groups, the Christian Coalition, Eagle Forum, and Family Resource Council. The movement is making a huge push to seize control of key states, including Ohio, where a group called Patriot Pastors have adopted as their symbol the cross superimposed on the American flag. When I attended a rally of Patriot Pastors in Dayton, a chorus sang militant hymns and patriotic songs while the crowd watched pictures of the war in Iraq. They must maintain the fiction of the separation of church and state, dodging their intent to build a theocratic Christian government, while at the same time sending out a stream of coded reassurances to their radical base. The movement has signed on dozens of cities and numerous states, such as Ohio, to a movement that will build people of what they call high character. Ohio is now a state of character. The state has put funding and resources aside to train citizens and leaders on how to be people of character. And potential candidates can fill out forms to declare they are persons of character, and their names are posted on the website. But woven into the 20-point list, which I urge you all to read, one which deftly eschews all religious terminology, is a blueprint for an authoritarian state, one where questioning power is unpatriotic, and only those with high character, as rigidly defined by Christians in the radical Christian right, have the right to lead and be heard. Individualism, the right to privacy, the belief that other political viewpoints and moral systems have value, are all attacked as disruptive to social cohesion. In the section titled Unity, followers are told, high character people strive to build relationships that foster oneness among others who are bound with them to a common promise, vision, mission, or purpose. Ethical organizations seek uniformity in their people's shared character ethics and unity among their otherwise richly diverse people. Without a preserving commitment to shared character ethics, there is no hope for sustainable unity. In a section titled Accountability, it talks about how to enforce this unity. High character people scrutinize themselves and welcome the scrutiny of others. Ethical people acknowledge that human nature compels us toward independence. Our preference for independence results in isolation from one another. Isolation breeds temptation to unethical conduct. Ethical people resist this chain reaction by adopting transparent life and work styles that invite inspection. Ethical people place themselves in relationships that motivate self-examination and encourage constructive critique from others, particularly those they serve. In the section called Honoring Authority, there is a reminder that without moral guides, people of high character go astray and deviate from the ethical standards imposed from above. All people are imperfect, it reads, requiring boundaries for behavior. High character people willingly yield to the authority of those who are charged with upholding those boundaries. Ethical people help shape and then abide by the legitimate laws, rules, and boundaries established by legitimate authorities and strive to live within those boundaries for the betterment of all people. When those given authority violate conscience-convicting ethics, ethical people take ethical action to restore ethical authority. And towards the end of the list, under the heading Our Ability to Change, there is a section titled Submission to Truth. Truth transforms people only when we submit to it. Truly high character people cannot not transform. Eventually, everyone ultimately confronts the power of truth. When confronted by the truth, ethical people are convinced to replace or put off their unethical behavior by pursuing and putting on ethical beliefs. Unethical people do not. This ongoing replacement lifestyle of ethical people produces the enduring evidences called virtues. All these points make, in essence, the same point. People of high character give over all authority for moral and political decisions to leaders who tell them what is true and what is right. All must, if they have high character, invite scrutiny by these leaders, by the organs of the state, and by their neighbors. These tenets are the cornerstone of the police state, the state where all are told to watch for social and political deviance, where there is only one orthodox truth, where all dissent is heresy, where people who are not of high character, people who do not submit and do what they are told, are not allowed to contaminate the public domain. Those of high character, those who abide by these moral tenets, become servile, afraid, bound to the tasks laid out by their leaders, willing to be punished for failing to achieve the moral standards and goals imposed by the state, and ready to denounce those around them. It is the antithesis of the message Jesus preached in the Gospels. President Bush must further these objectives, including the march to turn education and social welfare over to these churches with his faith-based initiative, which has handed hundreds of millions of taxpayer dollars to these organizations, as well as chip away at the wall between church and state with his judicial appointments, if he does not want to face a revolt within his core constituency. Hope has two beautiful daughters, Augustine wrote. Their names are anger and courage. Anger at the way things are, and courage to see that they do not remain the way they are. Anger when directed against those who would abuse the weak, preach bigotry and injustice, trample on the poor, crush dissent, and impose a religious tyranny is a blessing. Read the prophets. But because so many of our liberal institutions are bankrupt, bought off by corporate dollars, no longer willing to accept in religious terms that heretics exist, the goal is to appease the very people who openly call for our destruction. The liberal church stumbles along, muttering creeds they no longer believe, trying to peddle a fuzzy, feel-good theology that distorts and ignores the Bible often as much as the Christian right. And the Christian right is not always wrong about liberals. In fact, the movement voices much of our most prescient social criticism. They understand the ills of American society, even as they use these ills to plunge us into tyranny. They grasp the hollowness, timidity, and hypocrisy of the liberal church. The Christian right attacks cultural relativism, the creed that there is no absolute good and all value systems have equal merit, even as they benefit in a final irony from those who tolerate them in the name of cultural relativism. The most potent opposition to the movement will rise, I expect, from within the evangelical tradition itself. And the movement fears Christians who have remained loyal to the core values of the gospel, who delineate between right and wrong, who are willing to be vilified and attacked in the name of a higher good, and who have the courage to fight back. Most liberals, the movement has figured out, will stand complacently to be sheared like sheep, attempting to open dialogues and reach out their hands to those who spit venom in their face. Karl Popper, in the first volume of The Enemies of the Open Society, writes of what he calls the paradox of tolerance. Unlimited tolerance, he says, must lead to the disappearance of tolerance. If we extend unlimited tolerance even to those who are intolerant, if we are not prepared to defend a tolerant society against the onslaught of the intolerant, then the tolerant will be destroyed and tolerance with them. In this formulation, I do not imply, for instance, that we should always suppress the utterance of intolerant philosophies. As long as we can counter them by rational argument and keep them in check by public opinion, suppression would certainly be most unwise, but we should claim the right to suppress them if necessary by force, for it may easily turn out that they are not prepared to meet us on the level of rational argument, but begin by denouncing all argument. They may forbid their followers to listen to rational argument because it is deceptive, and teach them to answer arguments by the use of their fists or pistols. We should therefore claim, in the name of tolerance, the right not to tolerate the intolerant. We should claim that any movement preaching intolerance places itself outside the law, and we should consider incitement to intolerance and persecution as criminal, in the same way as we should consider incitement to murder or kidnapping or the revival of the slave trade as criminal. The Christian right has no religious legitimacy. It is a mass political movement. It ignores the core values of the Christian religion, summed up by Jesus in the Sermon on the Mount, and the core values of American democracy. They are, as the Reverend William Sloan Coffin said, not biblical literalists, as they claim, but selective literalists choosing bits and pieces of the Bible that conform to their ideology and bigotry, and ignoring, distorting, or making up the rest. We must begin to support those isolated groups and individuals who at some cost are fighting back, the clergy and rabbis who have banded together in Ohio to challenge in court the tax-exempt status of the megachurches that peddle this ideology and promote Christian candidates. The independent judges, such as the Republican-appointed judge in Dover, Pennsylvania, who banned the teaching of creationism in the public school because it is mythology, not science, as well as Cardinal Roger Mahoney, the head of the Archdiocese of Los Angeles, the nation's largest, who called on Catholics to be prepared to defy efforts in Congress backed by the religious right, to make it a felony to shield or protect or offer support to illegal immigrants. This bill would expand the definition of alien smuggling to theoretically include working in a soup kitchen, driving a friend to a bus stop, or caring for a neighbor's child. It would make mercy, compassion, and charity for the least among us a federal crime. In Mark Twain's book, The Adventures of Huckleberry Finn, it ends with Huck facing the moral dilemma we face. Whether to pay homage to a false moral code or damn ourselves in the eyes of many by opposing it. So I was full of trouble, full as I could be, and I didn't know what to do. At last I had an idea and I says, I'll go and write the letter and then see if I can pray. Why, it was astonishing the way I felt as light as a feather right straight off and my troubles all gone. So I got a piece of paper and a pencil, all glad and excited, and sat down and wrote, Miss Watson, your runaway Negro Jim is down here 2 miles below Pikesville, and Mr. Phelps has got him, and he will give him up for the reward if you send Huck Finn. I felt good and all washed clean of sin for the first time I had ever felt so in my life, and I knowed I could pray now. But I didn't do it straight off, but laid the paper down and sat there thinking. Thinking how good it was all this happened so, and how near I come to being lost and going to hell. And went on thinking. And got to thinking over our trip down the river. And I see Jim before me all the time, in the day and in the night time. Sometimes moonlight, sometimes storms. And we a-floating along, talking and singing and laughing. But somehow I couldn't seem to strike no places to harden me against him, but only the other kind. I'd see him standing my watch on top of his'n, instead of calling me so I could go on sleeping, and see how glad he was when I come back out of the fog, and when I come to him again in the swamp, up there where the feud was, and such like times, and would always call me honey, and pet me, and do everything he could think of for me, and how good he always was. And at last I struck the time I saved him by telling the men we had smallpox aboard, and he was so grateful and said I was the best friend old Jim ever had in the world and the only one he's got now. And then I happened to look around and see that paper. It was a close place. I took it up and held it in my hand. I was a-trembling because I'd got to decide forever betwixt two things, and I knowed it. I studied a minute, sort of holding my breath, and then says to myself, all right then, I'll go to hell, and tore it up. I do not deny the right of these Christian radicals to be, to believe and worship as they choose, but I will not engage in a dialogue with those who deny my right to be, who delegitimize my faith and denounce my struggle before God as worthless. All dialogue must include respect and tolerance for the belief, worth, and dignity of others, including those outside the nation and the faith. When this respect is denied, it is no longer a difference of opinion. It is a fight for survival. This movement seeks, in the name of Christianity and American democracy, to destroy that which it claims to defend. I do not believe that America will inevitably become a fascist state or that the Christian right is the Nazi party. but I do believe that the Christian right is a sworn and potent enemy of the open society. Its ideology bears within it the seeds of a religious fascism. In the event of a crisis, in the event of another catastrophic terrorist attack, an economic meltdown, or huge environmental disaster, the movement stands poised to ruthlessly reshape America in ways that have not been seen since the nation's founding. All Americans, not only those of faith, must learn to speak about this movement with a new vocabulary, to give up passivity, and to defend tolerance. The attacks by this movement on the rights and beliefs of Muslims, Jews, immigrants, gays, lesbians, women, scholars, scientists, those they dismiss as nominal Christians, and those they brand with a curse of secular humanist, is an attack on all of us, on our values, our religious freedoms, and our democracy. Tolerance is a virtue, but tolerance, coupled with passivity, is a vice. Thank you. I think we have time for questions, if anyone has any.
Do you feel at all encouraged by the midterm elections?
The question is whether I feel encouraged by the midterm elections. Certainly it's encouraging. For me, the engine of the movement is personal and economic despair. And that's the engine of all totalitarian movements. That's not an original thought. Fritz Stern wrote about this in The Politics of Cultural Despair. Hannah Arendt wrote about this in The Origins of Totalitarianism. Karl Popper understood this. And what we have done over the last few decades is disenfranchise tens of millions of people in this country. There's been a Weimarization of the American working class, many of whom come from my own family, where they can no longer get jobs which can sustain them in a dignified and meaningful way. And you go to some of the former manufacturing centers, as I have over the last 2 years, in places like Ohio, and the end of the world is no longer an abstraction to these people. And the disintegration of community has brought with it the social ills, the disintegration of family, addictions, domestic abuse, schools that no longer function, coupled, of course, with a removal of any kind of credible or meaningful federal assistance. And I blame much of that on the Clinton administration. And we are left in a situation where there is no check on the creation of a rapacious American oligarchy. We now live in a country where the top 1% of this nation controls more wealth than the bottom 90% combined. And when you create those kind of economic dislocations, when you shunt these people aside, and they're largely invisible now in press that is controlled by these corporations, the result is political deformation, political distortions, which is exactly what the Christian right is. Because what the Christian right does is it removes them from a reality-based world. It gives them a non-reality-based belief system that gives them a belief system in magic, where Jesus intervenes on a daily basis in their life, where God has a plan for them, where they are protected, supported. And once you remove, and we're talking about tens of millions of people in this country, once you remove this number of people from a reality-based world, and that, of course, is what creationism is about. It's not about an alternative. It is about the destruction of science. Facts become interchangeable with opinions. Lies become true. Facts that are inconvenient are simply discarded and ignored. And that, of course, is the very definition, as George Orwell understood, of how a totalitarian society works. And the first thing totalitarian movements do is they remove their own, their believers, from the reality-based world by conjuring up a lying world of consistency until they have the power to shut those iron gates and impose that world on the rest of us. And there is no hope to blunting this movement until we step in and re-enfranchise these people back into the society. This is a movement built on profound despair. And it is a despair, unfortunately, we have citizens have sat by complacently and allowed to happen.
The Pat Robertsons of the world quite obviously got a vehement attitude toward Islam. So do you think that those sentiments are fueled by ideological differences, or do you think it's political?
Well, the question is about the attitudes of people like Pat Robertson to Islam. Well, there's a frightening demonization of everybody who's outside the movement, including people of other faiths. It's a binary worldview, black and white, good and evil. And all of those who do not submit to this movement. And this is, of course, when you look closely at, you know, the type of power structure that they impose on their followers, one sees, I think, clearly on the micro level, the authoritarian or despotic quality of the movement. In the family unit, the male is the undisputed head of the household. The woman is subservient. I mean, people like James Dobson not only call on women to remove themselves from the workforce and stay at home, but to remove the children from the public schools, and the role of the women is to essentially be part of this indoctrinating process through Christian homeschooling, which is, of the, I think, 1.1 million people homeschooled in this country, I forget the exact figure, most of them are being filled with this frightening mythological vision of science, American history, and everything else. So there's a demonization of everyone outside the movement, not just Muslims. But of course, Muslims become, especially since Armageddon will supposedly take place in the Middle East, a wonderful kind of foil. And I think that what you see with leaders like this is a redirecting of that rage and that yearning for violence, especially apocalyptic violence, which they believe will be a kind of cleansing of the society, a redirecting of that rage, giving people a moral license to hate and even kill those who oppose them. And that's certainly what we're seeing in the Middle East. And all apocalyptic movements, which essentially is what this movement is, play off apocalyptic elements on the other side. So that, and of course, in many ways, they mirror each other. So that you find Islamic radicals in many ways mirroring Christian radicals. And I watched this, you know, in places like the Balkans. And what they do within their own societies is essentially destroy the center, destroy the moderate base within their own society, so that it becomes so polarized. And just as Franjo Tuđman, the dictator in Croatia, needed Slobodan Milosevic, who ran the Serbian nationalist movement out of Serbia, Milosevic needed Tuđman. You need people with a similar binary worldview, a similar penchant for violence, to play off of each other and destroy the centers within your own societies. That is happening in the Muslim world, but it's also happening here in the United States.
The Bush administration relating to the religious right?
Well, the religious right has gained tremendous inroads in the Bush administration, inroads that they never had before. There's been a hijacking of government scientific, of reproductive rights programs, AIDS research. They've, of course, received, as I mentioned, hundreds of millions of dollars. Very hard. People have tried to pin down the exact figure. It's very hard to pin it down. But certainly, you know, I mean, taxpayers' money is being given to Pat Robertson's Operation Blessing. I mean, these people are getting big money. Certainly there has been, at least up until the midterm elections, an attempt to politicize the judiciary by putting in ideologically driven judges. We see it within the military. We see there's a huge push by the radical Christian right to take over the chaplaincies. And this isn't a matter of presenting a particular religious viewpoint. It's about indoctrination. It's ultimately about the politicizing the military itself. So that, and if you go and look, if you can find it, because it got yanked off their website and they made YouTube take it down, but the Christian embassy put out a video after 9/11
where they went to the Pentagon, they interviewed senior officials, colonels, generals in the military, talking about their commitment to Christ, talking about the proselytizing efforts within the military. And that, coupled with these mercenary groups that they have created in Iraq, 25,000 mercenaries, groups like Blackwater, run by Eric Prince, a very secretive, multimillionaire figure, very close to the Christian right. What we're seeing is the effort to build a kind of Praetorian Guard. And I think, for me, one of the most chilling moments in the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina is when these Blackwater operatives, in their black uniforms and wraparound sunglasses and big SUVs and automatic weapons, appeared on the streets of New Orleans. In a moment of crisis, the ability to deploy mercenaries who are outside the legal structure on the streets of our cities brings us dangerously close to the collapse of the democratic state. Now, none of these movements, no totalitarian movement, is going to come to power unless there is a period of prolonged instability. And we don't have that now. But should we have it? I spent a year of my life covering Al-Qaeda for the New York Times, and there was not an intelligence official I interviewed here or in Europe who didn't speak about another catastrophic terrorist attack on American soil as an inevitability. Should that moment occur, should there be an economic collapse, should there be a series of environmental disasters, then what's to prevent these Blackwater operatives appearing on the streets of Washington? And that's the old question which destroyed what was left of the Roman Republic, is who guards the guards?
I'd just be curious to know what inspired you to write the book and to take up this subject.
Anger. I come out of the church. My father, who was probably the greatest influence on my life, a Presbyterian pastor in upstate New York, had combined that deep moral probity, no alcohol in the manse where I grew up. I never heard my father swear. We didn't work on Sunday. But with a commitment to social justice, which, like Adams, he believed was an integral part of the biblical message, so that he was involved in the civil rights movement. I think many people forget that in rural white enclaves such as the one I grew up in the early 1960s, Martin Luther King was one of the most hated men in America. And then went on to work in the anti-war movement. I remember when I was about 12 or 13, he told me that the war was still going on when I was 18 and I was drafted, he would go to prison with me. And I still carry this image of sitting in a jail cell with my dad. And he died in 1995, but the last years of his life were spent in the gay rights movement. His youngest brother, my uncle, was gay, so he had a real sensitivity to the pain of being a gay man in America in the 1950s and 60s. I went to Colgate University. There was no gay and lesbian organization. And when my father, by this time he had a church in Syracuse, found this out, it was about an hour away, he brought the gay speakers to my campus. This was in the 1970s. And this led to students confiding in my father after several of these visits that they were too uncomfortable coming out of the closet and founding a gay and lesbian organization on the campus. And so this was a problem my dad solved by taking me to lunch and telling me, although I wasn't gay, that I had to found it. So I founded. I used to walk into the dining hall and the guy would take my card for breakfast, lunch, or dinner and check it off and hand it back to me and go, "Faggot." So I made it my undergraduate mission to seduce his girlfriend.
I saw your piece in Salon, which I liked, but it occurs to me it must be a pretty tough sell to get media bookings for this for this book tour. Are you meeting a lot of resistance, or what's coming up?
No, I'm getting bookings. I've just started. But I think one of the things that surprised me is why I'm not challenged more on the use of the word fascism. I mean, it's a loaded term. I think generically the movement fits. I think when you read people like Paxton, I begin the book, for those of you who have a copy, with Umberto Eco's 14 qualities that make a blue shirt or black shirt, whatever the Italian fascists wore. Paxton, I think, writes correctly, and this is in his book Anatomy of Fascism, that, you know, all societies carry within them movements that essentially can be defined as fascist. He said that in our past, the Ku Klux Klan was probably the most authentically fascist movement created within American society. So I think they fit. I mean, I think that when you look at the cult of masculinity, the war against intellectualism, the obsession with violence as a way to cleanse the world, there are enough qualities within the movement to generically call it. But it's a loaded word. It brings up historical connotations. Fascist movements adopt indigenous symbols and language, which is something, you know, there's a great book, A Shall Bear Witness, by Klemperer, Victor Klemperer, who was a professor of Romance languages, I believe, in Leipzig, Jewish, and lost his post, and did sort of the first literary critique of the Nazi Party or National Socialism. And he understood how these movements hollow out words so that they use a comforting kind of vocabulary. They use symbols that that make us feel as if there's a kind of continuity. But they turn these symbols and this language to mean often things that are diametrically opposed to what the words have meant in the past. I mean, Orwell gets this with this kind of, you know, peace is war kind of thing. You see it in the word liberty. If you notice that President Bush, after he gave his nationwide address calling for the escalation of troop numbers in Iraq, ended. He didn't end by saying God bless America. He ended by talking about that force which gives us liberty. I forget the exact phrase. That liberty is an extremely loaded word, because liberty for people in the movement means the liberty that comes by giving your life over to and submitting completely to Jesus Christ. It means it's liberty as submission. So that when we hear the word liberty, it still continues to mean what we think it has always meant. But to the radical base, it's a message. And it's not a message, and you know, Bush has an evangelical speechwriter. It's a message. They constantly send out this stream of coded messages. And I think when you read Klemperer or Orwell, you understand very well that corruption of language, that poisoning of the civil discourse, which always presages the rise of totalitarian movements.
No, there are both. Been arguments that members of the Christian right are voting against their economic interests. How do they define their economic interests?
Yeah, that's Thomas Frank's argument. I don't think these people come from, you know, by the time they're wrapped in the embrace of this movement, by the time they spend all day long sitting in front of Sky Angel or TBN or the 700 Club, they have already been removed from the reality-based world. You know, I attended a seminar for the book in, I think it was either Missouri or Kansas, but it was a seminar for teachers, teachers in Christian schools, and it was instructing them on how to teach the process of creation. Now, you only need to read the book of Genesis once to understand that the writers of the book of Genesis thought the earth was flat. They not only thought the earth was flat, they thought there were rivers above and below us. In the creation story, God creates light on the first day and the sun on the fourth day. So this creates, obviously, the obvious question, what happened for the 4 days? And according to the instructor, God created a temporary light. Now, there's nothing in the Bible that even hints that God created a temporary light for that 4-day period. But I think it's in those kinds of details that you find how desperate these people are to hang on to this magical belief system, which is what it is. You know, the writers of the book of Genesis knew nothing about the process of creation. That's not why they wrote the book of Genesis. They were writing about the purpose of creation. And that is something that I believe they did know a lot about. It's why the Bible for me is worth reading. But when people live in a non-reality based world, when they believe that dinosaurs existed with Adam and Eve. I was at the $25 million Creation Museum in Kentucky, which I think is opening in a couple weeks. And, you know, they have a replica of the Garden of Eden. Adam and Eve are naked, but they're turned in such a way that you can't see breasts or anything. And they have dinosaurs there, and visitors are explained that in the Garden of Eden, dinosaurs were safe because they only ate plants, including T-Rex, and the reason he had long teeth is so he could open coconuts. This is all real. And that it was only after the fall that dinosaurs became meat eaters. There was a replica of Noah's Ark, and of course that thorny question of how you fit dinosaurs on an ark. And that was solved because Noah only put baby dinosaurs on the ark. I mean, you know, when you get down to that kind of level, you realize the absolute absurdity of the belief system. But while it's absurd, that's all these people have. And part of the rage that they feel towards critics comes from this fear of being pushed back in the reality-based world in which they could not cope, the world that betrayed them, the world that they yearn to be destroyed. And that's essentially what this obsession with apocalyptic violence is. It is about destroying the world that betrayed them, along with all of the people who betrayed them.
How many people do you think are just fellow travelers on this versus real hard believers? I must say, in my own family, we range from hard believers to let's get along at Thanksgiving dinner to me.
Right. Well, you know, all radical movements we know from writers like Crane Britton in his great book, Anatomy of a Revolution, are tiny. That hardcore, ruthless, manipulative, the James Dobsons of the world. I mean, single percentage numbers. It's small. I mean, what were the Bolsheviks? 1%? But they count on the sympathy of 80 to 100 million people who define themselves as evangelicals. And I think what's so fascinating for me about this movement is that these people are not fundamentalists and they're not evangelicals. I mean, fundamentalists have always called on followers to remove them, traditionally, to remove themselves from the contaminants of secular society, to shun politics because it's dirty. Traditional evangelical leaders like Billy Graham always called on their followers to be wary of political power. Graham himself was badly burned by Nixon. This is a new animal. We have not seen this before. We continue, and of course, they propagate those terms. We continue to use terms like fundamentalist to describe someone like Jerry Falwell. He's not a fundamentalist. Pat Robertson is not an evangelical. What we're seeing is something, a mutation, something radically different. We're seeing, in proper terms, dominionists, people who believe that they have been given a God-given right to run this country and ultimately to run the globe. And there's a huge chasm between these people and what we've seen in American society in the past.
Nick, this is our last question of the evening.
I mean, given what you were describing of the determination of the Christian right, the Dobsons, the Robertsons, the Falwells to impose their belief system on the society in terms of running the government, and the fact that they have been, you know, packing the federal judiciary, the hundreds of millions of dollars you're talking about, the fact they're in the White House, I mean, it seems to me that they're fairly far along on this path. We're not in a theocracy, but they're fairly far along, given, along with the things like the Military Commissions Act, the legalization of torture and holding people, I mean, all these different measures they've taken. And then you pose the question of what would happen if there was some other 9/11 incident or some other kind of catastrophe. And the question I wanted to pose is, based on your study of this whole movement and where you see this going, it doesn't seem like you have a whole lot of time. So from your viewpoint, what do you see doing now to stop this?
Well, the question is, how much time do we have? How far along is this movement? What worries me, I mean, I think that we're in a situation that's somewhat similar to the 1930s, where again we had a period where many, many people in this society had essentially been pushed out of mainstream society. There were powerful progressive forces within the press, which of course had a kind of multiplicity
that it no longer has. I think it's, if I'm correct, 80% of America's newspapers are controlled by 6 or 8 corporations. Broadcast journalism has virtually doesn't exist anymore, with the exception of C-SPAN and a few other NPR, but there's not much out there. I worry that we don't have the power, organized power, in the event of a crisis to stand up against them, that there may be a kind of individual reaction. I mean, I don't think most Americans, I don't think even most evangelicals want to live in the kind of America these people want to create. But of course, by then, by the time they find out, it will be too late. And one has to look at the transformation of any society at a moment of radical change. I mean, Iran would be a good example. When Ayatollah Khomeini came back, secular Iranians were cheering him in the street. The notion in 1979 that Iranian women would be forced to cover their heads was laughable. But there is a slow, gradual, almost imperceptible erosion that totalitarian movements make. I mean, the Nazis did it. It took them a very long time. Claudia Kunz's book, The Nazi Conscience, is a great read, or Sebastian Hoffner's Defying Hitler. You understand that this is a long process. And by the time people wake up, it's too late. That process is clearly underway, without question. And Hoffner writes, after the burning of the Reichstag and Hitler's declaring of martial law, how I think hundreds of thousands of Germans poured out into the street in protest, but there was no leadership. The opposition was bankrupt. In fact, the Social Democrats fled to a villa they had rented in Lugano in Switzerland. And without that opposition, without that, the ability of leaders to stand up, even the majority who opposes this move is essentially rendered impotent. And I fear that we keep moving down this path. And I don't find very many people standing up and ringing the kind of alarm bells. Certainly very few within the Democratic Party, which should be our opposition. Well, Webb is. I think Webb gets it, at least from my point of view. I mean, I think Webb gets the how dangerous this economic dislocation and the creation of an American oligarchy is to our democratic system. And that's not a new thought. I mean, Plutarch wrote about this. He said that disparity between the rich and the poor is the worst ailment that can beset any republic. Thucydides understood it. When Athens' empire expanded and many of the neighboring Greek states did not want to live under Athenian control, and Athens had to impose greater and greater tyranny, Thucydides wrote, "The tyranny we impose on others, we will eventually impose on ourselves." Which is, of course, what happened. It was the death of Athenian democracy. And I think when we look carefully at how we deal now with the rest of the world, we as a country are essentially capable of only speaking to people outside our gates in the language of violence. This language of violence is going to be brought home, already is being brought home. Look at our prison system. So that I you know, having spent 2 decades of my life outside the United States, the disparity between what I left and what I came back to is stark and frightening. Thank you very much.
Chris Hedges on American Fascists, the Christian Right, and the War on America. He's also author of War is a Force That Gives Us Meaning. A senior fellow at the Nation Institute and a contributor to The Nation magazine, you can read his